Good? Excellent. Thank you very much. So the first speaker is Donald Robertson, who just barely made it over here from Canada. The title of the talk is Stoicism, Mindfulness, and Cognitive Therapy. Don?
Cheers. Hi, everyone. I am as excited as a young Stoic can be to be talking to you guys today. Stoic Week's got bigger and bigger every year, and it's just amazing to see so many people in the hall today. And for those of you maybe who don't know, I also kind of organize the online course, and that's growing as well. We don't have quite as many this year as we had last year. We'll talk a little bit about that at the end, put a little plug in for it, but we do have thousands of people again online doing Stoic Week, so that's good as well. So this is my first time in the US, actually, and I was a little bit nervous because, you know, back in the good old days, there was only one famous Donald, and he was a duck. And people really liked that duck, so I didn't have any problems with that. But now I have to share my name with one of the most controversial men in the world. So I was a little bit nervous about that. And I kind of got held up coming here, because foolishly I had a connection to make in Toronto coming to the US, so I got held up at passport control. And the guy said to me, I realized now it was just a random check, but I was a bit kind of self-conscious at the time sitting there wondering if maybe I'd done something wrong. And the guy said to me, so what's the purpose of your visit to the US? And I said, I'm speaking at a conference about Stoicism. And he kind of gave me a blank look, pardon. And he said, what's it called? And I said, it's called StoicCon. And he gave me another kind of blank look. I said, I'm speaking at a conference about Stoic philosophy. And he said, did they invite you? Which I thought was a kind of strange question. Right. And being British, I had to really resist the urge to give a sarcastic response. But I thought better of it. Like, no, I was just going to rush the stage and grab the mic or something. Anyway, what I'm supposed to be talking about today is Stoicism, mindfulness, and CBT, which is one of my favorite areas. You can pay attention to what I'm saying right now, for example, and still be aware of how you're responding. For example, you guys could be aware of your facial expression and what you do with your eyes, your heart, your breathing, everything that you're feeling right now. And for Stoics, the most important thing is to be aware of your thoughts, especially the use you make from moment to moment of the impressions that you get, even during a presentation, for example, how you respond to things. You guys can't hear me. Do you want me to hold it? Okay. Is that better? A little bit? Better? Okay, cool. So either way, you can choose how you respond to your automatic thoughts and external impressions. And for Stoics, the goal is always to respond with wisdom, obviously. So let me tell you a little story about these things. My first book on Stoicism was called The Philosophy of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. I studied philosophy at Aberdeen University, and then a master's in philosophy and psychotherapy at Sheffield University. And I went on to work as a drugs counsellor and a schools counsellor in South London, and then as a psychotherapist in private practice in Harley Street, and as a supervisor and trainer of other therapists. Now, I've always had an interest in meditation. I was secretary of the Buddhist Society at university, and I studied Hinduism and Buddhism briefly in the History of Religions department at Aberdeen. I was also very interested in self-hypnosis. I went on to publish two books on hypnotherapy, one about its theory and one about its relationship with CBT. So when I was in my 20s, which seems like a long time ago now, I found that I had three areas of interest that I really felt I should be able to somehow integrate: academic philosophy, psychotherapy, and meditation. And actually, I know a lot of you guys have similar areas of interest, and that's why you're here. Try as I might, though, I couldn't find a satisfactory way to bring these three things together. Self-hypnosis helped me to combine my interests in psychotherapy and meditation. Studying existentialism helped me to combine my interests in philosophy and psychotherapy. However, something just didn't click in a way that brought the whole thing neatly together for me. Then I read a couple of books about Hellenistic philosophy by the French scholar Pierre Hadot. They're called Philosophy as a Way of Life and What is Ancient Philosophy, and I'm sure some of you have read them too. That's how I discovered Stoicism, and it was kind of an epiphany for me. I realized that Stoicism made sense of all my interests and brought them neatly together for me. It was kind of like Buddhism, but more Western, I felt. It seemed also, in some ways, kind of like Christianity, but more secular. It seemed like modern academic philosophy, but more practical and more down to earth. And it seemed like modern psychotherapy in some ways, especially CBT, but kind of grander in scope and more philosophical. Stoicism offered a whole philosophy of life, a worldview and a set of moral values to live by, which is something much more than therapy normally has to offer. However, Hadot's account of Stoicism also provided numerous examples of textual evidence showing that Hellenistic philosophies in general contained a variety of what he called spiritual exercises. Now, they might be spiritual, but I would also call these psychological techniques or strategies. And I noticed that they were very similar, or in some cases even identical, to strategies that modern psychotherapists like myself were employing. However, I couldn't find a comprehensive study that linked these ancient spiritual exercises to their modern equivalents. So I set about writing one. And that's how my first book on Stoicism came about. And I felt like my job was kind of easy, because Hadot's books provided me with the groundwork by documenting many spiritual exercises, and all I had to do then was kind of put them side by side with exercises from REBT and CBT beside their modern equivalents. And as I researched the book, there were several things that became apparent to me. Number one, from my perspective as a psychotherapist, I could spot a few additional psychological techniques in the ancient literature that Hadot hadn't mentioned. For example, something Beck called cognitive distancing, which I'll return to shortly. Although therapeutic techniques can be found in most ancient Greek schools of philosophy, point number two, they were clearly most prominent in the Stoic school. Number three, there are hundreds of schools of modern psychotherapy, but it was clearly CBT that had most in common with Stoicism, specifically the rational emotive behavior therapy, or REBT, of Albert Ellis, and to some extent, Beck's cognitive therapy, because it drew heavily on Ellis's work. Also, point number four, early 20th century rational psychotherapy that preceded Beck and Ellis by about half a century also drew heavily on Stoicism. Though once influential authors, such as Charles Baudouin and Paul Dubois, were now almost forgotten. Most psychotherapists probably haven't even heard of those guys, although at one point Dubois was almost as famous as Freud at the start of the 20th century. Point number five, both Beck and Ellis referred to Stoicism as one of the major philosophical inspirations for their therapies. Beck, and to a greater extent Ellis, refer to and quoted from the ancient Stoics. For example, in the first modern CBT treatment manual for a specific disorder, The Cognitive Therapy of Depression, it's a seminal text in modern CBT, written in 1979, Beck and his colleagues wrote, and I quote, "The philosophical origins of cognitive therapy can be traced back to the Stoic philosophers. Zeno, Chrysippus, Cicero, Seneca, Epictetus, and Marcus Aurelius." Then they say Epictetus wrote in the Enchiridion, "Men are disturbed not by things, but by the views which they take of them." And it's important that they give that quote. I'll come back to that again. Incidentally, that's clearly derived from a passage written 17 years earlier in a book by Albert Ellis called Reason and Emotion in Psychotherapy, even down to the point that they mistakenly include Cicero, who is actually a Platonist and not a Stoic. Now, as I was contemplating my survey of the parallels between Stoicism and CBT, something kind of began to bug me, to nag at me. It seemed to me that there was one very prominent aspect of ancient Stoic philosophy that had been overlooked by the followers of Beck and Ellis, to some extent. That was what I would call Stoic mindfulness. Now, to be clear, early CBT literature did make some references to mindfulness meditation. However, that was inspired by Buddhism, not by Stoicism. Moreover, since the 1990s, there's been a much greater emphasis on the concept of mindfulness in CBT. Some of you might be aware of that. We're not just talking about one new form of therapy, but rather a whole movement consisting of several distinct therapies, usually referred to as the third wave of CBT, or as mindfulness and acceptance-based therapy. For example, acceptance and commitment therapy, metacognitive therapy, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, behavioral activation, and many others. Again, these approaches were inspired mainly by Buddhist mindfulness meditation, and they tend to make little or no reference at all to Stoicism, which is ironic because the emphasis on mindfulness and the here and now, which CBT increasingly adapted from Buddhism, was already a central focus of Stoicism. However, despite drawing on many other aspects of Stoicism, the Stoics' emphasis on mindfulness was more or less completely ignored by modern psychotherapists. Incidentally, a bit of trivia for you, the word mindfulness, although it seems very familiar now, wasn't widely used until around about the 1980s. So what do we mean by Stoic mindfulness? And I appreciate some people read the Stoics and they don't really see the connection with mindfulness, although to me it's pretty evident, and I'll explain why in a moment. Although I can remember a time when people said they couldn't see any connection between Stoicism and CBT, they couldn't see any psychological strategies in Stoicism, and now I think that's fairly widely understood, partly from Haddo's work and maybe partly from mine, that there are clearly identifiable psychological techniques in Stoicism. So what do we mean by Stoic mindfulness? Well, it's the type of mindfulness that's described by Seneca, Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, and others as an integral part of the Stoic art of living. It seems to me that there are three main aspects to it, to put it very simply. Number one, self-awareness. Continual attention to our own mental activity, specifically to our ruling faculty, hegemonikon, and our value judgments. So a constant monitoring of our mind, basically our judgments and our impressions. Number two, a focus on the here and now. Attention to the present moment, where our locus of control is situated, because we don't have control over the past, we don't have control over the future. And this is a particularly prominent theme in the writings of Marcus Aurelius. And number three, and this is the tricky part, a kind of psychological detachment. Viewing our automatic thoughts and feelings, which the Stoics call impressions or fantasia, with philosophical objectivity. Epictetus tells his students to say to troubling impressions, you're just an impression and not at all the thing that you claim to represent. Now, that's a very important quote in this respect, and I'll elaborate on that in a moment because it's a tricky concept. We call that cognitive distancing in CBT. There are other terms used for it, like metacognitive awareness and stuff, but Beck called it cognitive distancing, and that's the term that I tend to use. So by Stoic mindfulness, I mean focusing attention on one's innermost mental activity in the here and now, with a special kind of detachment towards our stream of consciousness. These are all recurring ideas which pervade the Stoic literature, especially the form of late Roman Stoicism that seems to have been transmitted from Musonius Rufus to his student Epictetus via Junius Rusticus down to Marcus Aurelius. Most people get roughly what it means to pay attention to your thoughts and to dwell in the here and now, grounded in the present moment. However, the third aspect, cognitive distancing, is a trickier concept. It's usually defined as the ability to view thoughts as events in our mind rather than identifying them with reality. So Beck defines it as follows, and I quote, distancing refers to the ability to view one's own thoughts or beliefs as constructions of reality rather than as reality itself. So not confusing thoughts with facts. That's tricky because when we're thinking about stuff, we naturally tend to conflate our thoughts and judgments with external reality, and we have to kind of pause for thought, take a step back to view our thoughts as mere hypotheses. Although we do it to other people all the time. So in a sense, viewing our thoughts with that kind of objectivity is a little bit like viewing them as if they were the thoughts of another person. That's what we mean by gaining cognitive distance. So Beck explained this to his clients by talking about the difference between looking at the world through rose-tinted glasses on one hand, and on the other hand, taking those glasses off and looking at them. Does that kind of make sense? Yeah. You can also describe it as an attitude that involves looking at our thoughts more objectively. That's what we mean by gaining cognitive distance. Some people would say that's a necessary precursor to any kind of critical evaluation or disputation of our thoughts. That's how Beck presented it. We have to be able to treat our thoughts as mere hypotheses in order to weigh up evidence for and against them, or to weigh up their pros and cons. That's initially how it was understood in CBT. However, later, third wave therapists argued that merely adopting this attitude of distance on its own was sufficient to bring about quite powerful therapeutic changes in many cases, particularly the ACT therapists. So they initially called what they did radical distancing, if I remember rightly, or comprehensive distancing, I think was the term they used. And later they replaced it with the term cognitive verbal defusion. So these guys said, well, maybe just this distancing could be beneficial without going on to dispute and evaluate our thoughts. Albert Ellis said that at the beginning of therapy, during what we now call the socialization phase, he taught most of his clients the famous quotation from Epictetus that I mentioned a moment ago. It's not things that upset us, but our judgments about them, the one that Beck referred to. Incidentally, at least until recently, in my experience, that was virtually the only thing that most CBT practitioners knew about Stoicism, bizarrely. Beck and Ellis refer a lot more frequently than that to Stoicism, but many of the CBT practitioners that I met had no real acquaintance with Stoicism at all, apart from that one quote from Epictetus. Although occasionally you'd meet people that had delved into the literature that are a little bit more curious about where it came from. Now that is cognitive distancing. Teaching that quote is teaching a form of cognitive distancing. Teaching people to view their thoughts as separate from reality is something that inevitably happens when we teach them it's not things that upset us, but it's our judgments about them. So here are some other techniques that are used in CBT. I know people find it useful. It's a shame we haven't got more time to kind of do a workshop on this, but I'll just rattle off a list of some of the things that maybe help to explain the technique. So number one, keeping a written thought record so that you can see your thoughts on paper and often notice their repetitive nature is a way of gaining distance sometimes. Writing thoughts in a board or a diagram and literally viewing them from a distance from the other side of the room. Visualizing thoughts written on a cloud or on a placard or floating down a stream in a detached manner. Giving a vague feeling a shape or color and viewing it as an object. Repeating thoughts aloud very slowly with pauses or very quickly over and over and over again is a way of gaining distance from the thoughts. Saying, I notice right now that I'm having the thought, blah, 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 is a way of gaining distance from thoughts. Or referring to your thoughts in the third person, like I notice right now that Donald is thinking about ducks again or whatever. Training yourself to just do nothing, which seems odd maybe, but that's one of my favorite approaches. It's the metacognitive therapy approach developed by Adrian Wells. Doing nothing is surprisingly difficult. And of course, mindfulness-type meditation techniques like those derived from Buddhism. Epictetus repeatedly tells his students to say, as I mentioned earlier, this is just an impression and not at all the thing that it claims to represent. That's one of his techniques. Or to remember that other people might view the same event differently. And he tells his students repeatedly, I think about half a dozen times in the discourses and in the Enchiridion, he tells his students to postpone responding to upsetting thoughts until any strong passions have naturally abated. Now, that's similar to what we might call a timeout strategy or a worry postponement strategy in modern therapy. Here's just a couple of quotes to illustrate that. He uses the same Greek term repeatedly to refer to this. He says, for example, in the first place, do not allow yourself to be carried away by the intensity of your impressions, but say, impression, wait for me a little. Another quote, when you get an impression of some pleasure, guard yourself, as with impressions in general, against being carried away by it. Let the matter wait upon your leisure and give yourself a little delay. Another one, and so make it your primary endeavor, he says, not to be carried away by the impression. For if once you gain time and delay, you will more easily become master of yourself. You actually find this concept in Platonic literature, other philosophical schools as well, but it's particularly prominent in the Stoic school, not allowing yourself to be swept along, washed away, carried away by the tide of your thoughts, by ruminative thoughts, we might say now, or worrying. Epictetus says that once we've gained distance from automatic impressions and allowed time for our feelings to calm down, to naturally abate, we can return to them later and properly evaluate the consequences, the pros and cons, or dispute them, compare them to what a wise man like Socrates would do, or consider whether they relate to things that are up to us or not, which is one of his central themes, obviously. So that's what I was trying to do yesterday in Toronto airport for 4 hours. I think it went reasonably okay. So a quick plug for Stoic Week. The website is modernstoicism.com, all one word. And we have just over 2,000 people enrolled. How many people here are actually enrolled to do the online course? Cool, it's quite a lot of you, right? Okay, so if the rest of you enrolled as well, we'd have even more people doing it, which would be really cool. So the more people, the merrier, basically, because it helps to spread the word. And, you know, like one of the most amazing things that's come out of what we've done, and this is not something that we could easily show you, although actually it's available online for you to read. Tim LeBon does a report every year on Stoic Week. And one of the things that he does is just to compile a lot of data, but also the qualitative feedback. So we ask people, like, how did you get on? Like, what did you think of it? And we have, like, from thousands of people, reams and reams and reams of feedback from them, you know, sometimes complaining about technical problems, but often saying, not just like, you know, this was really beneficial, but this was a life-transforming experience for me. And I'm sure there are people here today who have done that course or, you know, read our blog or whatever, and it's kind of just act as the catalyst for them to get deeper into Stoicism. If nothing else, if we just got people to read Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, and Epictetus more, I would die happy, right? I mean, you know, you can't ask better than that. That would be awesome. And so a lot of people tell us, yeah, I'm really into this now and I've been reading all the books and stuff. But they also tell us that it helped them to get through really tough psychological, emotional problems as well. Now, as a therapist, that's something that you hear every day, right? But it's still inspiring. And you can get kind of desensitized to it in a way because you're maybe seeing 20, 30 clients a week or whatever, and you're hearing a lot about the progress that they're making. But the feedback from Stoic Week was some of the most humbling feedback I've ever read. It was people saying not only that they'd overcome specific problems, but their whole worldview had been transformed. Like, and they felt that it was a life-changing experience for them. So if I sound a bit kind of euphoric about it, like, it's just inspiring to read that stuff. And sometimes I don't think, because we're Stoics, maybe we don't really kind of sell what we're doing enough. But if you guys want to go online and have a look at the feedback from previous years, it gives you some motivation to kind of carry on studying Stoicism and keep telling other people about it. So I just wanted to do that little final plug. I think, do we have 5 minutes for questions? Okay, how are we going to do this? Do you guys want to put up your hands if you have a question then? And do we have like a roaming mic or anything like that? It's roamed off. Oh, we don't have a roaming mic. Okay. Yeah, you guys can just like yell. So somebody like... do you want to put up your hand if you've got any questions? And then we'll just kind of like pick people at random. Bill. Well, it's an interesting thing because many people in therapy assume that when automatic thoughts pop into their mind in general, that they almost feel like they kind of have to engage with those thoughts, and they feel it's kind of repressing or suppressing thoughts. It's unnatural not to engage with them. I think they kind of took that from old sort of cod psychology, Freudian literature and stuff, right? So we often meet clients in therapy say, well, I shouldn't be ignoring my thoughts and stuff, should I? But actually, there are many situations in life where it's perfectly natural to do that. And one of them is when you're trying to go to sleep. Or another one would be any situation where you're trying to do something and you don't, like in the middle of a presentation, if I suddenly think about Donald Duck, right? I don't allow myself to kind of engage with that train of thought and be swept away by it. It's perfectly natural for me to ignore it. Now, the trick is not to try to forcefully suppress thoughts because that tends to backfire. The more we try to push thoughts actively out of our mind, the more they tend to keep popping back in. So there's a knack that we have to learn that takes a bit of practice. This cognitive distancing strategy that I was talking about. that basically boils down to doing nothing in response to these thoughts and adopting a detached attitude to them, neither picking them up nor pushing them away, but just kind of going, meh, in response to them and doing nothing, which is harder than it sounds, right? There are little guys that sit in caves for decades staring at the wall practicing to do that. Like, people practice meditation for their entire lives to get that knack, disengaging from automatic thoughts. But there are a bunch of techniques that we teach in therapy that can help people to do that. And sometimes in bed, if those thoughts are particularly intrusive, the recommendation is that people get out of bed and go and do something else rather than allowing themselves to associate rumination with lying down in bed trying to get to sleep. This lady here. Yeah, it's exactly the same. Like, perseverative thoughts about anxiety, we tend to call worry. Like, that's the term that therapists will use for these kind of repeated recurring thoughts. And one of the main techniques that's used for worry, there are many CBT strategies that are used for severe worry, but they all tend to be variations of worry postponement. That technique, there's a number of versions of it, but generally it involves noticing what you're worrying about and then maybe very briefly writing down what the topic is and arranging a specific time to go back and think about it later when your feelings have abated somewhat. And maybe even sitting in a specific place, having a specific time of day, which is called your worry time. So paradoxically, deliberately worrying, or deliberately thinking about these things tends to take away some of the automaticity from them. And that's a technique that when it was initially tested with college students, they found a 50% reduction in the frequency, intensity, and duration of their anxiety without doing anything else, just that technique of worry postponement.
Are we out of time?
Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks, Dan.